copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
It was Gary Wolfe in Wired magazine, an article that coined the phrase the New Atheism. But the New Atheist movement has adopted that name since, a little bit like the way that Christians have adopted the name Christian, even though that's not what they called themselves at first. It was the name coined for them by the non-Christians and then gets adopted. And Gary Wolfe, in his article called The Church of the Non-Believers, said something about he was an agnostic journalist, said something about the way that he was viewing the movement. In 2006, he said, the New Atheists condemn not just belief in God, but respect for belief in God. Yeah. Religion's not only wrong in the sense of being intellectually mistaken, in their view, it's evil. And in my analysis, the heart of the neo-atheist religion is evil critique there is their misunderstanding of what it is to have religious faith. The new atheists think of themselves as standing up for reason and rationality. On the one hand, they conflate reason and rationality with scientific ways of knowing things. So they have a sort of scientistic theory of knowledge, a very narrow theory of knowledge, which gets them into problems on the one hand. And they portray all religious faith as automatically a matter of blind faith on the other. And will therefore say, look, okay, I know that there's a difference between jihadi Muslims of a certain kind flying planes into buildings and strapping bombs onto themselves to go kill people, on the one hand, and the C of E vicar at the church fete raising money for the church roof so that he can do good works in the community, on the other. Of course there's a difference, but... And you might say, well, one's obviously dangerous, and the other is doing nothing but good for society, surely. Even if you don't believe, you think there's lots of good social work and so on done by the church. But no, the vicar, as much as the jihadist, has faith. And that means blind faith. And that means not paying attention to your intellectual responsibilities. And if you're of a mindset that you're not concerned to pay attention to your intellectual responsibilities, then of course you're a field day for people who want to convince you to go and fly aeroplanes into buildings, because you're basically living your life without thinking about it. So the mild-mannered C of E vicar at the Tea Party is dangerous for society, and we need to expunge religion from the certainly from the public square, and at best make it a matter of private religious practice as a hobby. There was an atheist in a recent documentary film who said, I look forward to the day when religion is like knitting. I look forward to the day when religion is like knitting. It's sort of a harmless pastime that you can do if you like that sort of thing, but you just do it, you know, on your own, in private. Doesn't affect anybody else. Don't force your knitting on me. You know, I'm glad you like knitting, but that's not for me. And that can be your sort of attitude towards religion. So, to also somewhat simplistically, perhaps, but to boil down New Atheism into a memorable formula, what is it that sort of distinguishes this type of atheism from other types? Because just as there are different types of Christian denomination, there are different types of atheist denomination, if you like. And just as unfortunately in history, there have been quarrels and disagreements between Christian denominations, there are quarrels and disagreements, sometimes in raised voices and such, between different types of atheists. But the new atheists seem to me to combine scientism as their theory of knowledge. We only know things through science. With materialism as a worldview, combined with a moral sort of socio-moral crusade against religion as a social danger, for the reasons that I've explained. And the conjunction of those three things I would say, put someone squarely in the new atheist camp. So we'll as we're doing today, specifically look at the Jesus and new atheist issue, and start off looking at this distinction you may have heard between the Jesus of faith and the Christ of history in New Testament studies. And as a sort of backbone in the background of our thinking today, I think it would be useful to just grasp this helpfully illustrated chain of testimony. See what I did there? Yes. When we're thinking about issues of the historical reliability of the New Testament reports about Jesus and so on, I think it's very useful to think of this chain of testimony. You have four links in the chain, basically. Link one is between the reported events of, in this case, Christ's life, but this applies to any sort of historical reporting, the reported events and the reporting source of our knowledge about those events. So you have events happening in history, and we get information about that event from some source of testimony about it. The second link is the link between that reporting source and them recording, in the case of ancient history, writing down, usually, their testimony about what happened. And that may be, you know, very, very small or quite large. That gap, that link. Number three, link three, is the link between that original written source of information, it's called the autograph, and the surviving copies of that original written source. Because it's true to say for the wide majority of ancient history, we do not have the original document that someone wrote telling us about something. What we have are more or fewer copies of what they originally wrote. And so the fourth link is the link between the autograph that the source of our information recorded and our ability to reconstruct from the surviving copies of that autograph what the source recorded, what they said in that autograph. So in each case, for each link, the stronger that link is, the better, obviously. The first two links, they concern the origins of the testimony that we have about something, if you like. The origins of the testimony to what happened, and links three and four concern the transmission through time to us of that testimony. So the origins of the testimony itself and then the transmission of that testimony to us, and each has two links in them. Now that sort of analysis stands behind a lot of standard apologetics for New Testament historicity. There's another approach that can overlap and combine with that, an approach that uses so-called criteria of authenticity, sort of criteria that historians and New Testament historians will use, where you can say, even if the document that the text that I'm applying these criteria to, even if I thought that was a generally unreliable source of information, nonetheless, I think I've got some criteria that if I can find something in this perhaps generally unreliable document that passes this test, if you like, I would think that at least that bit of information from this source is probably reliable anyway. So you see, there's a difference between arguing, okay, this text that we have is a generally reliable source of information about what happened back then. That's one route to go. And another route to go is to say, here are various tests that I can apply to the information we have now that we can reconstruct. And if things go through these tests, then I would trust them. They are things like looking for Aramaic sources. So there are various times in the Gospels, for example, where, although they're generally written in Greek, suddenly they go into Aramaic, which is the language that Jesus and his disciples would have spoken day to day. And many historians think, well, that is an indication that you've got very early information about Jesus, because it's become established that that's, you know, this is the Aramaic from the original situation, rather than it's just in Greek and, you know, someone could have made it up later or whatever. That's an indication that we are getting early information. Looking for independent sources, just like in a court of law, the more witnesses give you the same information independently of one another, without colluding with one another, the more reliable you think that particular bit of information is going to be. Multiple sources is also useful. There's an overlap here, but they're not the same thing. But it's useful, but perhaps independent multiple sources is more useful. Looking for eyewitness sources, if you've got someone who's saying this is eyewitness testimony, well, that's better than second-hand or third-hand information, obviously. Looking for early sources, the earlier the report about, the better, because there's less time for people to forget things and get confused and so on. Embarrassing sources, people don't tend to tell stories that portray themselves in a bad light, if they can help it. So if you find someone from, you know, the book of Mark saying, yeah, Peter denied Christ, I think, oh, well, okay, that Peter probably denied Christ, because it would be unlikely that the early church would paint one of the founding apostles of their movement as having done something so embarrassing if they didn't have good reason to think that he'd done that. And what's called enemy sources, or you know, if you can find a Jewish or a Roman source that gives you the same bit of information that the Gospels do, that's great, because they haven't got any bias to agree with Christians. So if they happen to agree with them on something, then that's a good sign that we've got a reliable bit of information. Now, using such, these are positive criteria. You can't take these and say, oh, look, nothing in this text has gone through it, therefore it must all be rubbish. They're only positive tests. But using positive criteria to validate specific historical claims is, of course, compatible with thinking that the sources those claims are in are generally unreliable. But the greater application you find the tests have to a document or set of documents, the more that indicates the general reliability of those documents. If all sorts of these tests keep applying again and again and again to the New Testament, as you look at it, then of course your confidence that it's generally reliable is going to go up, quite rightly. So there's a sort of relationship between these two approaches, although they can be used independently. Now, here is not a new atheist. I will quote some not new atheists, but I think they tell us something interesting about the way in which people approach studying the historical Jesus. Atheist Colin McGinn, he's a philosopher of mind from the States. He says, I still admire many of the teachings of Jesus Christ and find his life exemplary of some important moral truths. But I long ago rejected the supernatural baggage that accompanies Christian belief. Okay. So here we have an atheist who accepts some of the historical record about Jesus. For example, he thinks that we can reasonably claim that Jesus existed, that Jesus gave some ethical teachings with which he happens to agree, and so on. So there's part of the historical record that he will accept. But then he rejects the historical record that we have about Jesus when it comes to anything that smacks of the supernatural. Well, of course he would, because he's an atheist. Yeah, okay. Likewise, Philip Pullman, who's perhaps more in the new atheist direction, said recently, Jesus was a great storyteller. To invent the story about the Good Samaritan, you hear it once, you never forget it. You tell it to somebody else, and it still has the same effect. The man was a genius of storytelling, if nothing else. Okay, mild praise, but there again, atheist accepts some of the historical record about Jesus, his existence, his ethical teachings, etc., but rejects the historical record about Jesus when it concerns anything supernatural. Well, when you think of the story of the Good Samaritan, what's our historical reasons for believing that Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan? It appears in a probably second-hand report of one gospel. It's in Luke. That was written at the earliest 30 years after. Many scholars would put it later. I'd put it about 30 years after. So we've got one second-hand report at least 30 years after the event, because Luke was not an eyewitness. Nevertheless, it's interesting to note that 60% of the very liberal Jesus seminar rated this teaching as red in their colour beads voting about the authenticity of passages, authentic. And a further 29% rated it pink, i.e. probably authentic. And yet, some of the supernatural baggage about Jesus in the historical reports is clearly, therefore, supported by a lot more historical evidence than some of the ethical teaching and so on that atheists like McGinn and Pullman are willing to accept. So clearly, that whether or not they accept something about the historical Jesus doesn't really seem to rely upon the question how much historical evidence is there for it. It relies upon the question, what's my worldview? What kind of events am I willing to accept historical evidence for, and so on. I think New Testament scholar Helen Bond kind of puts the state of play well here. She says, in her introduction to the historical Jesus, she says, modern academic study, put scare quotes around this, modern academic study of the historical Jesus only really began in the wake of the 18th century Enlightenment, with its rejection of a God who intervenes in history in supernatural ways. The emergence of historical criticism in the 19th century allowed distinctions to be made between the Christ of faith and the Jesus of history. Distinctions that have underpinned the quest for the historical Jesus ever since. And I think that's a kind of standard guild view, if you like. Well, I could pass a number of comments about this. I don't want to dive too much into pointing out that the Enlightenment was not a monolithic anti-God movement, that of course a lot of leading lights in the Enlightenment were Christian philosophers and scholars. But let that one slide. But the rejection of a God who intervenes in history in supernatural ways, quote unquote, does not allow, as Bond says, the distinction between the Christ of faith and the Jesus of history. It actually requires that distinction. And it requires that distinction completely regardless of the historical evidence. So the modern academic study of the historical Jesus described by Bond is the search for a Jesus that's consistent with metaphysical naturalism or a materialistic worldview. That's its starting intention. And that means that the Jesus who is happily acknowledged by many atheists, like Colin McGinn and so on, and agnostics, of course, is a Jesus of faith. An understanding of Jesus shaped by faith in naturalism, rather than a Jesus of history. An understanding of Jesus produced by following the historical evidence where it leads. So the Guild thinks it's doing proper historical criticism by making a distinction between the Jesus of faith, which is what all the religious people who don't pay attention to evidence believe in, and the Jesus of history, which was us proper academic folk who know about the Enlightenment, are doing. And I would suggest that that is precisely the opposite of what is actually going on. Precisely the opposite. Now, there are three basic approaches to trying to draw this line of distinction or demarcation between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. I'll go through these three ways and then we'll pause again. So there's a metaphysical approach, sort of philosophical approach, that says miracles, supernatural things, can't happen. There's an epistemological, a theory of knowledge-based approach that says miracles can't be known to have happened. Well, that's a different thing, because you could say, well, I believe it's possible for miracles to happen, but nonetheless, I don't believe it's possible for us to ever know that they've happened, you see. And the third way of drawing the line of demarcation is a definitional approach that says something like, miracles can't be mentioned within history as a subject. Sometimes you'll find New Testament historians sort of saying, and clearly they know Jesus was dead and there was an empty tomb and various people thought they saw him alive afterwards. But as to what really happened, historically speaking, we can't say as academic historians because, well, I'm just not allowed to go there as a historian. That history doesn't deal with that question. So the metaphysical approach, miracles can't happen. French neo-atheist Michel Onfray, they're mainly English writers, but there were a few on the continent as well. And he says we should approach any purportedly holy book from a standpoint hostile to revelation. And he assumes the answer to his rhetorical question, who would have done the revealing, is of course nobody. So if there's no one to do any revealing, there can't be any revelation from God. Now, note, that being so, if you thought that, you'd better not approach, say, the New Testament demanding evidence for the revelatory status of the Gospels, say. I mean, doing that would obviously involve a massive double standard. Christopher Hitchens thought that David Hume, quote, wrote the last word on the subject of miracles. He was wrong about this. William Lane Craig reports that the fallaciousness of Hume's reasoning about miracles has been recognized by the majority of philosophers writing on the subject today, and that's the majority of philosophers who look at the issue, not the majority of Bible-believing or God-believing philosophers. And I think it boils down to this, as Morland and Craig point out, it's really, if you believe in a God, then you have to believe that miracles are possible. So to believe that miracles aren't possible, you've got to have a good argument for thinking there is no God. You've got to have an argument for atheism in order to exclude the possibility of miracles. The attempt to have an argument against the possibility of miracles that is not ipso facto an argument against God is a busted flush. And here are some more recent writings about miracles that show that the contemporary debate is still very much ongoing and much more sophisticated than it was in David Hume's day. Even neo-atheists like Lawrence Krauss, who's a cosmologist, says, a God who can create the laws of nature can presumably also circumvent them at will. So, you know, new atheists are not wrong about everything, and they don't all agree with each other about everything. and when you can quote one against the other, that's a useful rhetorical move to do, because, of course, he has no bias. That means he wants to disagree, as, of course, I do. So the theory of knowledge approach, the sort of saying miracles even if they're possible, can't be known to have happened. This is interesting to look at Daniel Dennett, new atheist philosopher from the States. He says, in the end, there is no true religion in the factual sense, for there is no good evidence supporting their truth claims. That seems to be a straightforward statement of why he doesn't believe in Christianity, say, because he's saying there's no evidence. Then it says, historical arguments simply cannot be introduced into serious investigation of God or gods, since they're manifestly question-begging. I think he's thinking, well, in order to think that there's been a miracle, a revelatory act of God, you've got to already believe that there is a God. But that's not true. You have to be open to the possibility that there's a God, but you could be agnostic about the issue of whether or not there's a God, and then look at some evidence, say for the resurrection or whatever, and then conclude, I think the best explanation of that is that it was a miracle done by, say, a God. So he's not quite right about that. But actually, he begs the question even more clearly against revelation when he invokes the scientific method with its assumption of no miracles. This scientistic kind of theory of knowledge. If you're saying, on the one hand, I don't believe because there's not enough evidence, but then you're saying, on the other hand, but there couldn't be any evidence of anything beyond a naturalistic worldview's ability to explain things, and how on earth do you ever think you're going to get evidence of something beyond a naturalistic worldview? Dawkins does the same thing. He criticizes religious faith famously as requiring blind trust in the absence or even in the teeth of evidence. So again, clearly the problem here is the lack of evidence for miracles. There's no evidence. But Dawkins also asserts the 19th century is the last time when it's possible for an educated person to admit to believing in miracles without embarrassment. It's always fascinated me that the psychological depth of insight that Richard Dawkins has to me, even though he's never met me, clearly he knows that I'm embarrassed to say I believe in miracles. I'm not, by the way. But again, there's a tension here. He's saying, on the one hand, the problem is a lack of evidence for miracles, but on the other hand, I won't believe any evidence for miracles. This is what we call a double standard. Did Jesus, asked Dawkins, come alive again 3 days after being crucified? There is an answer to every such question, whether or not we can discover it in practice, and it is a strictly scientific answer. However, Dawkins explicitly rejects that apparently open-minded, well, let's explore a posteriori, on the basis of experience, on the basis of the evidence, what the answer to that question is. And he rejects it on a priori, before experience grounds. He says, suppose something happens that we don't understand and we can't see how it could be a fraud or trickery or lies. Would it ever be right to conclude that it must be supernatural? No. So, again, he seems to give with one hand, but then draw back with the other hand from a natural engagement with the evidence that he appears to be demanding. They appear to be criticizing religion for not having the evidence, but they actually refuse to engage on the basis of the evidence. I'm sure, as J.C.A. Gaskin put it, when something altogether extraordinary is reported, the wise man will require more evidence than usual and will check and recheck the evidence very carefully. Nevertheless, at some stage, in his accumulation of respectable evidence, the wise man will be in danger of becoming dogmatic and obscurantist if he did not believe the evidence for a miracle. This interesting book called Hume's Abject Failure, The Argument Against Miracles by John Earman, who is an agnostic philosopher. And he says, a theory of knowledge that does not allow for the possibility that evidence from eyewitnesses or other sources can establish the credibility of a UFO a walking on water or a resurrection is inadequate. Since he argues that your theory of knowledge has to at least be open to saying, I can conceive that it's possible that there are some, in some cases, be enough evidence to convince me that a miracle has happened. And if you're not saying that, then at the very least, you can't say, I am open to being convinced by the evidence, and the reason I don't believe you about your claims is because there's not enough evidence. Because also you're secretly saying with out of the back of your mouth, as it were, and there could never be, in principle, enough evidence, so I'm not going to bother engaging with it. The definitional approach, miracles can't be mentioned within history. Oh, okay, well, this seems to me just to make history a very boring subject, and I much prefer the subject of smystery, which is a subject that asks the question, what actually happened and what's the evidence? Tell us about that. You know, if history is not a search for what happened, it seems to me to be a bit of an odd subject. It was Albert Schweitzer back in the day who said the exclusion of miracle from our view of history has been universally recognized as a principle of criticism. Just go along with the crowd, you know, so that miracle no longer concerns the historian either positively or negatively. And the Jesus Seminar jumped on the same bandwagon, and they endorsed D.F. Strauss's distinction between the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith that we've talked about. So that was the first pillar of scholarly wisdom. And they contend that by definition, the historical Jesus must be a non-supernatural figure. But the seminar thereby guarantees, by definition, that miraculous explanations are non-historical, irrespective of the evidence, and irrespective of the facts of the matter as well. This is just to gut history of its interest for me, really. But again, atheist philosopher of science Bradley Montan, talking in the context of talking about intelligent design theory, but you can apply this here as well in the discussion within how do we define history as well as how do we define science. Despite being an atheist, not an atheist, I'm wrong about everything, says if science really is permanently committed to methodological naturalism, that is this idea that you do science, or let's say do history, as if naturalism were true, although you're not committing yourself to saying it is or isn't, it follows that the aim of history is not generating true theories. Instead, the aim of history would be something like generating the best historical theory that can be formulated subject to the restriction that the theory is naturalistic. Science is better off, history is better off, without being shackled by methodological naturalism. And if you want to define it that way, then I want to go down the corridor and found a new university department, as they say, that'll look at some more interesting questions. Again, atheist Thomas Nagel notes that a purely semantic classification of a hypothesis or its denial as belonging or not belonging to science or history is of limited interest to someone who wants to know whether the hypothesis is true or not. That's the question. And surely in these cases, evidence is germane to answering that question. So as the atheist W.V. Quine said, if I saw indirect explanatory benefit in positing spirits, a creator, a god, I would joyfully accord them scientific status on a par with quarks and black holes. For Quine, the question was, what is your theory and is there evidence that supports it or not? So, some atheists, including some neo-atheists, as we've seen, appear to attack Christianity by wielding these very scientific-sounding demands for evidence and give people the impression that there's a sort of evidential problem with religious belief. And of course they have this false assumption that Christians have no evidence because faith is a matter of blind faith, isn't it? So you know, Christians aren't interested in in evidence, are we? What's actually going on in the background is a rejection of miracles and the supernatural on philosophical a priori grounds. And that is a double standard, or as we say in the vernacular, hypocrisy. The so-called Jesus of history is actually a Jesus of faith in various a priori constraints on how you think of history. And there's three different ways of doing that that we've looked at. So I think there is no good reason why the so-called Christ of faith should not also be the Christ of history if the evidence supports that conclusion. And I want to hold kind of the skeptic's nose to the grindstone on that issue and call them on that hypocrisy. And like the friend that I mentioned earlier, he took Richard Dawkins at his word when he said, the thing is, you've got to not have blind faith, and it's important to look at the evidence and think about your beliefs and weigh the case. And, oh dear, he actually took him seriously and started doing it in a way that I think is patent that guys like Richard Dawkins don't do. But this is a passage of quotations from various pages of Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, saying the typical kind of new atheist thing that they say about the Gospels. I'm not going to read out the whole thing for you, but you can see where it starts with the typical, ever since the 19th century, it's like we had the 19th century historical criticism of the Bible started, and then the last 150 years of New Testament studies didn't bother happening, as far as the new atheists are concerned, because we had this breakthrough moment when we're all skeptical about the Bible, and they haven't really learnt that things have become progressively less skeptical as we go through from the first to the second to the third quest for the historical Jesus and so on. They'll talk about the copies being recopied through Chinese whisper generations, so demeaning one of those links in the chain of testimony, or sort of attack them. The people who wrote it didn't know Jesus. Nobody knows who the four evangelists were. That they almost certainly never met Jesus personally. What they wrote was not an honest attempt at history. Reputable Bible scholars don't regard the New Testament as reliable records of what actually happened. The only difference between the Da Vinci Code and the Gospels is that the Gospels are ancient fiction, while the Da Vinci Code is modern fiction. It's astounding stuff. But people who don't have a background to say any otherwise might well believe a respected media figure from Oxford University telling them this in a best-selling book. You know, all of this, all of it is false. Dawkins asserts the Gospels are pure fiction. Christopher Hitchens, Holy Writ is probably fiction of a grand sort to begin with. Alex Rosenberg states the Bible is, quote, fictional. As I could quote New Testament scholars today at the cutting edge ad infinitum practically, this is just not the current view. N.T. Wright says one of the great gains of New Testament scholarship in the last generation has been to re-establish that the canonical Gospels certainly were intended and certainly are to be read within the framework of ancient biographical writing. They are not works of fiction. They are at least intending to tell us what happened. The Gospels are a type of Greco-Roman biography. Richard Burridge, I know Richard Burridge. I sit on a trustees panel with him for a charity, and he wrote the book on this subject, What Are the Gospels? A Comparison of Greco-Roman Biography. It's now into a second edition, and Burridge says the Gospels belong to the genre of Greco-Roman bios, a life of a historical person written within the lifetime of contemporaries. When were the Gospels written? And again, the New Atheists are saying, oh, it's decades, hundreds of years later. They're really, really late. The four Gospels of our Bible had all been written by the end of the first century, is the view in the Guild. The rough consensus, as Williams, seems to be sometime between AD 60 and AD 90. though both earlier and later dates have been proposed. So I've put here a little chart. Here's some rather conservative sort of range of dates for the Gospels. Here is some rather liberal range of dates for the Gospels. Here in brackets is the specific dates that I would argue for purely on the basis of circumstantial evidence. That's all you can really do once you've bracketed between when Jesus died and the end of the first century, I think. But I think you can mount some good arguments for going towards the earlier dates. But hey, notice, the thing to notice here, the big take home, is there is really very little difference in the datings between the conservative and liberal end of the historical guild on when the Gospels were written, and everybody agrees they were written in the first century. What about the authors, the authorities, the sources of those Gospels? Again, they didn't know what they were talking about. They didn't know Jesus, etc., says Dawkins. Timothy Paul Jones puts this very carefully. He says, the best evidence that we possess suggests that the sources for the four Gospels were a tax collector named Matthew, Simon Peter's translator, Mark, the physician, Luke, who knew Paul and traveled with Paul sometimes, and a fisherman named John. Mark Roberts, in recent years, many have come to believe that the first and fourth Gospels reflect the memory and the perspective of Jesus' own disciples. Now, again, Matthew and John may not have been the ones who finally put pen to papyrus. There are interesting discussions, for example, about whether John's Gospel in particular went through a number of editions, that maybe John wrote what we could consider a first draft of the Gospel, and then John's disciples tidied it up and finally published it when John was very old, or when he died towards the end of the first century. There are interesting discussions there. Actually, the discussions about when a Gospel is finally published, focusing on that too much doesn't take into account discussions about whether or not they went through multiple drafts or versions, for example. Matthew and John may not have been the ones who finally put pen to papyrus, but they, their memory, their authority, stand behind the Gospels that bear their names. And in the other two cases, you've got people who were very close associates of major early apostolic church figures. Richard Bockham, I really recommend to you his book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. It's a gem of a book on this. He says that, argues that the Gospels embody the testimony of eyewitnesses. Not, of course, without editing and interpretation by the authors, but in a way that's substantially faithful to how the eyewitnesses themselves told it. And he goes into the literary signs within first century literary culture that you were quoting someone. And that's important because in New Testament Greek, there is no such thing as a quotation mark. You can't quote someone in New Testament Greek. So how do you indicate to your literary audience when you're doing that? And Bockham looks at the signs and looks at the way in which, particularly when you have a named character that appears just within a particular story area, as it were, and particularly when that named character appears at the beginning and the end of a passage, it's like putting quotation marks by putting the name of the person at the beginning and the end of the passage that is based on their testimony. It's a way of saying, this story comes from so-and-so. And Bockham goes into that in some detail in his book. It's fascinating stuff. So here's a chart, and it's in your information. And I'll put this in a more visual form in a moment. Thinking of the New Testament authors compared with lots of other standard authors from ancient history. And we're looking at what are the dates of the events being reported? And of course, those events can span a period of time. When was the report published in its final form? So what is the average lapse between the events happening historically and the final published report of it? What's the average lapse there at the end? So what's the lapse? Because it spans time, and then what's the average lapse in the last column at the end there. Now, of course, most gospel scholars accept dates ranging from the 60s to the 90s, and I've said I would early argue for earlier dates, but it doesn't affect it that much, and I'll show you on some charts that it's easy to see that that difference doesn't affect this very much. So here's it in graphic form. The average gap between historical event and the written report, Plutarch might you consider a bit of an outlier, because the average gap from the events he's talking about to when he's talking about them is about 300 years. But, you know, back at the other extreme, we have Pliny, the Letters of Pliny, who is talking about practically contemporaneous events. And Thucydides, and then Mark, and Xenophon, and Polybius, and then Luke, and Matthew, and John. And then the histories of Tacitus, and Herodotus, and Suetonius, and Josephus's Jewish War, and the Antiquities. So you can see that in terms of that criteria, as it were, that measurement, the gap between the events and report, and remember we were talking about you want it to be as short as possible, historically speaking, comparing the New Testament Gospels to other standard works of ancient history, and I'm not data picking them just to make a point, I'm trying to pick the next best ones. You see they fit in very comfortably by that criteria, such that if you wanted to say, I'm skeptical of the information in the Gospels because they were written too long after the events, which is exactly what people like Dawkins say, to be consistent, you would also have to say, and I don't trust anything that Josephus tells us. And I don't trust anything that Herodotus or Suetonius or Tacitus tells us. In other words, let's shut down the classics department at the university. Now, for some reason, the New Atheists aren't agitating for Oxford University to close down its classical history department. I wonder why. That's where the average lapse would be if you took the standard sort of liberal dating of the Gospels. They would all fall within that band there. So you can see that it really makes very little difference to Mark, makes the most difference to. And of course, focusing on the Gospels, not only can you over-focus on the final publication of the final form of the Gospel question at the expense of maybe there was a period of writing it over a number of years, incorporating new sources, polishing it over time, so that the gospel actually gives us access to information that's earlier than the final publication date. It's like if you took one of my books on the table there and say, oh, it was published in 2013. But then you read the foreword, and you notice the foreword was written in 2012. So a book that's published in 2013, it's giving you access to information that was written in 2012, because it took a year for the publisher to publish the thing, you know, to get it out there, and so on. But also then, what if I drew upon and quoted from and so on other sources that predate the publication date and my writing of it? And this is the general schema that the New Testament Guild thinks about in terms of sources that stand behind the New Testament Gospels. There's one called Q, from the German word for source, which is sought to be the information that both Matthew and Luke quote and incorporate into their Gospels. If you line Matthew and Luke up together, you see that there's information that's common to both of them. That is not in the other Gospels. Matthew seems to have an additional source called M, funnily enough. Luke seems to have one, and that might mean several sources, but a source or more called L. And it's often thought that the passion story in Mark's Gospel, when you get through Mark's Gospel, you read, it's lots of very bam, 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 this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, little nuggets, bam, 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 bam. And then you get to the passion narrative, and you suddenly have a long literary unit, and many scholars think that that is a source from the Jerusalem church that predates the publication of Matthew's Gospel, and what Mark's Gospel and what he's done is combined the preaching stories of Peter that he was conveying and translating and so on for the church in Rome, and he's combined those Petrine sources with this long passion narrative that predates him, and he's combined those together. And some scholars, although fewer, think that John perhaps had a sign source about the particular miracles that he mentions. And you can also note, cross-reference these sources with the New Testament letters. So Paul Barnett, who's a Christian ancient historian, points out that the Q texts are cited or echoed in letters of Paul written in the mid-50s AD. So particularly if you have later datings of the Gospels, you can show that at least bits of the material that ends up in those Gospels are quoted in New Testament letters, which is interesting. And indeed, we can argue that at least elements of Mark's Gospel, of Q, L, and M existed within 20 years of the historical Jesus at most. So if we look at, another one of these charts of average gaps, this is the average gap between the event and the report, as it were, in the publication of the Gospels, compared to these sources. But then this bar is showing us the gap between the events and the report for Gospel sources. So this is for the Gospel publications. That bar is for the Gospel sources that predate the Gospel. So again, you can see it, if this is John and Matthew and so on, the sources that he's drawing upon push it back earlier in history. So the Gospels actually give us access to earlier source material. And then the final link in the four elements of the chain of testimony is that between the autographs, the writing down originally of the information, and what we can confidently reassemble today from the scraps of copies that we have. What you generally tend to have is very early on, you have tiny little scraps of papyrus and things, and then later on you start getting whole books of the Bible, and then later on you get entire New Testaments, simply because the further back in time you're going, the more time there's been for things to erode. So again, the Gospels are here. So if you're looking for complete copies of New Testament, of Gospels, of Gospel books, you're looking about 300 years after the autograph, for say a complete copy of Matthew or whatever. If you're looking for early Gospel fragments, EGFs I call them, like the John Ryland's papyrus fragment of John's Gospel and so on, you can push that back really quite early. The next best, and Homer, the Odyssey, the Iliad, is the next best historical comparison from the ancient world. And that's a little bit later for entire copies. And then Pliny, Horace, and Tacitus, and Suetonius, and Plato, and blah, 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 all the way down to Aristophanes here, 1,500 years after the publication of Aristophanes' plays, before you can get a complete copy of his play. And yet, ancient historians will quite happily work with the works of Thucydides or Herodotus critically, using criteria and so on, but they're happy to use them. So again, clearly, if you wanted to use that gap between autograph and copy as a reason to be skeptical of New Testament information, to be consistent, you have to apply the same rule with devastating effects on the classics department. So Sam Harris, he expresses a concern about the currently available text of the New Testament being evidenced by discrepant and fragmentary copies of copies of copies of ancient Greek manuscripts. He sort of pictures it as a game of, the game that's sometimes called telephone in America, or Chinese whispers, where one person tells the next person in secret the information, and that person tells the next person in secret the information. It's like, we've got the original autograph, and then somebody copies it, and then somebody else copies that, and somebody else copies that, and all we have is 5% of what they copied, and 10% of what they said, and so on. And from that, we're trying to piece together what was originally said. That can't be reliable, can it? And he talks about the way in which the copies are discrepant. You think about it, there's something a little bit odd about that criticism, because in order for us to notice discrepancies between copies of the Gospels, you've got to have enough copies for there to be that overlap with one another to notice discrepancies. And it's actually the huge number of New Testament manuscripts that are available that leads to a fact that sometimes people like Bart Ehrman will sort of quote, will say, you know, there's so many thousands and thousands of discrepancies between the New Testament manuscripts. How can you trust them? Well, there are only thousands, though, you know, there are more discrepancies than there are words in the New Testament. You think, oh, gosh. But that is a factor of the fact that we have so many New Testament documents available. And we have these documents available over a long period of time, yes, in bigger and bigger chunks, in different languages that are spreading out geographically from where the Gospels are first published. So, you know, it's Mark's published in Greek, and then someone makes a copy in Latin, and someone else makes a copy in Egyptian, and someone else makes a copy in Syriac. And then other people make copies of the Egyptian one, and other people make copies of the Syriac one, and other people, and we have these sort of branching, sort of evolutionary trees of common descent, if you like, but literary trees of descent, and we can compare what's said in that language, in that language, in that language, at this historical date, at that historical date, and so on. All these different ways of comparing them, and because we have such a massive amount of textual data, on the one hand, that means, yes, there's lots of differences, most of which are things like sort of grammatical differences that don't actually affect the meaning of the words and the sentences, or spelling mistakes that are obvious, and so on. But because we have such a massive amount of data, we can be much more confident about the reconstruction of what the original autograph probably said in the terms of the New Testament than we can about the rest of ancient literature, because this chart compares just the Greek manuscript evidence. So ignore the Egyptian and the Syriac and the Latin and so on, just the Greek manuscript evidence for the New Testament text with the total manuscript evidence for other ancient texts, including the next closest, which is, again, Homer, the Iliad in this occasion. So Homer's Iliad, we have 1,074, last time I looked, copies, fragments of Homer's Iliad from which to reconstruct the autograph, as it were. For the New Testament, we have 5,700-odd copies and fragments from which to reconstruct the original. Now, yes, that means, of course, that means there's a lot more variation in that pile of papers than there's going to be in this pile of papers, because it's a heck of a bigger pile of papers. But that also means we can be much more confident about reconstructing what's back here, because we've got a lot more data to go on, you see. So, again, if Sam Harris is worried about this copying copies of copies of copies, if he applied the same worry to the rest of ancient history, you know, Plato, 7. Herodotus's work, 8. Tacitus's, 10 fragments and copies, you know. Then again, you would just be in shtuck about this. And folks, we're not going to close down the classics departments or the ancient history departments. So this new atheist critique is just superficial and uninformed. 2 modern myths about Jesus pervaded by the new atheists. Jesus probably didn't exist. And the idea that he was divine doesn't originate with Jesus and his original disciples. It's a later sort of evolutionary development of thought It takes a process of a lot of time. And as Dan Brown says in the Da Vinci Code, you know, nobody thought of Jesus as divine until they voted on it at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. So Richard Dawkins says it's even possible to mount a Sirius, though not widely supported. He does at least admit that. Not the widely supported historical case that Jesus never lived at all, as has been done by, among others, Professor G.A. Wells of the University of London. You think, oh, Professor Wells of the University of London, who Dawkins does not tell you is not a historian, but a professor of German. So then you start thinking, oh, that's interesting that he's quoting someone who's outside the field to critique it. Nor does he actually tell you that Wells believes that the Q document does contain historical information about a Jewish teacher. And in fact, it seems there's been an evolution of Wells' views. He's quite a well-known Jesus skeptic, but he now seems to think that there are two Jewish teachers who are confused with Jesus. So he's gone from not believing in a historical Jesus to believing in two, sort of. So things are more complicated, in other words, than Dawkins lets on. Even Dawkins does begrudgingly admit Jesus probably existed. Okay, so even if you're meeting people influenced by the new atheists who are saying it's probable Jesus didn't exist, you know, I've been reading this, that, or the other, to be able to point out to them, look, even the new atheists, even Richard Dawkins says Jesus probably existed. Let's move on, thank you very much. New atheist Victor Stenger asserts a number of scholars have made the case for the non-historicity of Jesus, and their conclusions are convincing. So he's going even further than Dawkins. He's endorsing Jesus' mythicism here. He says, in another typical new atheist screed, he says, there is not a single piece of independent historical evidence, by which he presumably means independent of the Bible, evidence for the existence of Jesus or the veracity of the events described in the New Testament. Not a single piece of independent evidence. Even the much-touted statement by the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus is now accepted by almost all scholars as a forgery. The paragraph in Antiquities that mentions Christ, his wonderful works, death on the cross, and appearance 3 days later, does not appear in the earliest copies of that work, and not until the 4th century. Seems very damning of the case for historical Christ. All of that is false. It's just false. He is wrong on each and every count there, each and every claim. Here's a slide from an atheist blog I found online, and it's a picture of Bart Ehrman, the agnostic New Testament scholar, and a quote from him. And in this quote, Bart Ehrman says, in the entire first Christian century, Jesus is not mentioned by a single Greek or Roman historian, religion scholar, politician, philosopher, or poet. His name never occurs in a single inscription, and it is never found in a single piece of private correspondence. Zero zip references. Okay. Well, first, considering that Paul was a Roman citizen, don't the writings of Paul count as first century personal correspondence by a Roman religious scholar who mentions Jesus? Secondly, what about the writings of a certain Greek doctor and sometimes traveling companion of Paul called Luke? Luke is a first century Greek historian. Third, one can't ignore evidence from non-Christian sources in the second century, particularly the early second century. That is not too late to do history with. Fourth, one can't discount Christian sources from the second century, like Ignatius and Polycarp, who knew apostles like Peter and John. There is a direct line of relationship there. So you can't ignore non-Christian second century or Christian second century sources. Fifth, Ehrman grants the importance of the first century Christian testimony about Jesus. And we'll come back to that. And sixth, one can't discount the archaeological, including, I would argue, inscriptional evidence of Jesus. We'll come back to that as well. So, what about extra-biblical early Christian sources? So here we have Jesus and the eyewitness generation, if you like, and guys like Peter and John and Philip the evangelist, and he has some daughters. And then there are guys like Ignatius and Papias and Polycarp and Irenaeus, who knew various of these people. So Ignatius of Antioch, early 2nd century martyr, he was torn to shreds by lions. He was a disciple of the Apostle John. We're told by various sources that the Apostle Peter appointed Ignatius bishop. He refused to deny Christ and was thrown to the lions in Rome. And Eusebius says Ignatius was martyred in about 108 AD. So this is very early, 2nd century, that he gives up his life for Christ. This is 217 years, Dan Brown, before the Council of Nicaea. And Ignatius wrote of, quote, our God, Jesus. Nobody thought of Jesus as divine until the Council. Now, this is 217 years before, and I haven't gone to the New Testament. I've just gone to 108 AD at the latest there. A couple of quotes from Ignatius, where he has these sort of practically creedal passages. He encourages the folks he's writing to about Jesus Christ who died that you might escape death through faith in his death. And that's obviously why he's willing to go to his death at the Moors of Lyons. Turn a deaf ear to any speaker who avoids mention of Jesus Christ, who was of David's line, born of Mary, who was truly born, ate and drank. Now the interesting thing about this is he is countering an early Christian heresy that particularly Greco-Roman influenced people of a spiritual bent were tempted by in the beginning of the second century. That early heresy is to agree with the Christians that Jesus is divine, but to deny that he was human. I think that's an interesting point. He truly born, ate and drank, was truly persecuted under Pontius Pilate, cruelly crucified and died, was truly raised from the dead, the Father having raised him, who in like manner will raise us, even if we're torn to shreds by lions, for believing this. Now this quote from Bart Ehrman, used by the blog that I took it from, where is that quote from? It's from Bart Ehrman's book, Did Jesus Exist? Subtitle, The Historical Argument for Jesus of Nazareth. It's a book in which Bart Ehrman argues against the Jesus mythicists, that there is good historical reason to believe that Jesus really existed. And yet, this quote, out of context, is being used to push a mythicist view. So, Bart Ehrman, although quite known as a skeptic, who in other contexts the New Atheists love to quote because of his skepticism on these issues, says, with respect to Jesus, we have numerous independent accounts of his life in the sources lying behind the Gospels and the writings of Paul, sources that originated in Jesus' native tongue of Aramaic and that can be dated to within just a year or two of his life. Historical sources like that are pretty astounding for an ancient figure of any kind. So, depending on which bits of Bart Ehrman you quote, you can paint him as an extreme skeptic or practically as sounding like an evangelical Bible scholar. You know, you've got to put these things in context. Bart Ehrman points out that Paul must have converted to believe in Jesus within 2 or 3 years of the date of Jesus' death. And Paul knew some facts about Jesus' life. He knew some of his teachings. He knew his closest disciple, Peter. He knew his brother, James, personally. If Jesus didn't exist, you would think that his brother would know about it, says Bart Ehrman. That's a great point, isn't it? The historian can't simply ignore what Paul has to say since he was a Christian. Taking his biases into account, we can use his letters for information about Jesus and they show beyond a doubt that Jesus existed as a Jewish teacher in Palestine. And Victor Stenger, back to Victor Stenger, remember, there's no independent historical evidence for the existence of Jesus. He says, in fact, there isn't a shred of independent evidence that Jesus Christ is a historical figure.
I wonder what he means by independent.
Yeah, I think he means...
Some government-sanctioned documentarian went along with a film crew.
Yeah.
What is it that he...
Yeah. I think he means not Christian. But as Bart Ehrman says, you can't just say, oh, it's a Christian, therefore I'm not going to believe it. It's a bit like saying, someone's arguing that we should be skeptical that the Holocaust happened, and there's been a part of it happened just down the road. We pass it in the coach on the way back to the airport, some of us. Didn't happen because you can't trust the reports of those Jews who survived it, like Primo Levi and so on, because they're biased, aren't they? Because they believed it happened, because they were there, you know? So they're biased. You can't, like... So we're not going to believe Paul about it because, like, he knew Jesus' brother. He's biased. Michel Onfray makes the only slightly less incautious claim that there are only two or three vague references to Jesus in ancient texts. So Onfray doesn't agree with Stenger, at least. Gary Habermas says that ancient secular sources, so not Christian, independent in that sense, corroborate the picture presented by the Gospels. They include ancient historians such as Tacitus, Suetonius, Thallius, Josephus, the Talmud, Pliny the Younger, the Roman Caesars Trajan and Hadrian describe early Christian beliefs and practices about Jesus. Greek historian and satirist Lucian and Syrian Marabar Serpian provide other details. At least 17 non-Christian writings record more than 50 details concerning the life, teachings, death, and resurrection of Jesus, plus details concerning the earliest church. Dated approximately 20 to 150 years after Jesus' death, these secular sources are quite early by the standards of ancient historiography, as we've seen. Indeed, I think he says there's about a dozen non-Christian sources that independently mention the death of Jesus. And I said we come back to inscriptional. There was a stage where this would have been more controversial for me to say, but this 1st century AD chalk ossuary, bone box, when after the initial internment of someone, you come back once the flesh is gone and you intern the bones in an ossuary box. This is something the Jews did in the 1st century before the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And this chalk ossuary is dated to the mid-1st century. That's about 30 years after the crucifixion. There's an inscription on it. You might just be able to make out here. It's repeated up here. We're reading right to left because this is in Hebrew. Jacob bar Yosef Achid Joshua. That is James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. James was martyred, as we know from Josephus, about AD 62. So that ties up with the date. Ben Witherington says, if, as seems probable, the ossuary found in the vicinity of Jerusalem and dated to about AD 63 is indeed the burial box of James, the brother of Jesus, as it says, this inscription is the most important extra-biblical evidence of its kind. Paul Almayer, historian, says there's a strong, though not absolutely conclusive, evidence that yes, the ossuary and its inscription are not only authentic, but the inscribed names are the New Testament personalities. Herschel Shanks, who's the editor of Biblical Archaeology Review magazine, argues that this box is more likely the ossuary of James, the brother of Jesus of Nazareth, than not. And you might be interested in looking at his book with Ben Witherington, The Brother of Jesus. This was controversial because there was a stage of the Israeli authorities accusing various collectors of forging various apparent historical archaeological finds. And this box, as a lot of things are, wasn't actually dug up in situ, but its significance was recognized when it was already in the collection of a collector. And he was accused by the Israeli authorities of having forged the inscription on the old box. And he was actually taken to court by the Israeli authorities, and the court case collapsed and vindicated the collector. So we've been through that. So if you read some archaeology books on the New Testament from a few years ago, they will mention this and then say, but it is a forgery. But now it seems that the evidence has gone the other way. The court case has collapsed and vindicated him. And as you can see, a number of respected scholars in the field say that, yes, this is, it's not knocked down, but there is a good case to be made. So even probably inscriptional first evidence, century AD evidence for the existence of Jesus. So Giza Vermes, who died recently, is a Jewish New Testament scholar, not a Christian, argues in his book, The Resurrection, Jesus was a real historical person. In my opinion, the difficulties arising from the denial of his existence still vociferously maintained in a small circle of rationalist dogmatists far exceed those deriving from its acceptance. Bart Ehrman says, whether we like it or not, Jesus certainly existed. We have more evidence, indeed, he says, we have more evidence for Jesus than we have for almost anybody from his time period, says Bart Ehrman. So you've got these miracles that are evidenced by multiple criteria of historicity, and clearly they're best understood against the Old Testament background as kind of enacted claims to prophethood and divinity on Jesus's part. Now, even if you were minded to say, taking a skeptical stance, I don't think miracles happen, I don't think they happened, what are these stories, what's the function of these stories within that literature, therefore? Clearly they're being told to convey the idea that Jesus is divine. Even if you don't think they're true stories, the function of the story is to make the claim that Jesus is divine. So that's, you know, without going to the sort of direct, where can we see, you know, Jesus saying, I am, and so on. Or saying, you know, looking into the Son of Man and the background of all that. So, but these miracle stories, evinced by multiple criteria, also make this point indirectly. The Lord is my shepherd, and here is Jesus, of course, as the shepherd. This is right above the baptistry in that church. Jesus carrying a sheep. I am the good shepherd, says Jesus in John. This is a fascinating bit of archaeology. A number of years ago, they were trying to extend a prison in Megiddo. They're going to build a new prison block or something, and they stumbled across a bit of archaeology. Not only a series of small walls, as you often get in archaeological situations, but a wonderful mosaic floor. We're looking down on a mosaic floor here. We've got a sort of plinth for a table. The tabletop's missing. We've got these wonderfully elaborate mosaics around here. Discovered in 2005 and dated by the pottery and so on to about 230 AD. So that's, what, 200 years after the death of Christ. Here's a closer-up, although somewhat grainy, picture. Note, first of all, these fish in the mosaic here. There's a closer-up detail of the fish. And we know, of course, that the ichthus, the fish in Greek, was an early Greek symbol for Christians, because the letters of the word fish, ichthus, was an acrostic for Jesus Christus Theos Iosota, that is, Jesus Christ, God's Son, Saviour. So that's quite interesting to find archaeological information that I think pretty clearly shows this community were Christians who thought of Jesus as God's Son. They're using this fish symbol. But you might perhaps argue, oh no, this is just a reference to the feeding of the 5,000, or which is an inactive claim to divinity. So I think it comes back to, there's an interesting thing here with the fish. But this is the real clincher. This inscription here, with the underlined word, the God-loving Acaptus has offered the table to God Jesus Christ as a memorial. The famous Alex Aminos graffiti, or in the Latin, graffito, such a different language, wall graffiti near Palatine Hill in Rome, generally dated. I've seen a range of dates for this, but Richard Bockham says about AD 200, so maybe a little earlier than that church floor. And again, you have the donkey-headed man on a cross who's been crucified. That really is to make an ass of yourself, to get yourself crucified, culturally speaking. But who really is the bigger ass here? The guy who's crucified, or this guy, Anaximenes, who is worshipping his god? What an idiot! He's worshipping a crucified bloke. What a wally, you know. And so some guy has done this bit of graffiti. Anaximenes worships his god, or some translations say, it says, Anaximenes, worship your god. And it says something about the cultural context of the cultural shame and embarrassment of trying to promulgate a religion in which you say, yeah, I've got a new religion that you might want to consider joining. We follow a guy who was crucified. That's quite a big cultural ask, you can see, in the context. This is a report from 2011 from the Live Science website. Researchers identify what's believed to be the world's earliest surviving Christian inscription. So I should mention, of course, the key word here is worships. Worships his god. So this Anaximenes is clearly thinking of Jesus. I mean, who else could that be in context as divine? About 280. Life Science. The world's earliest surviving Christian, or semi-Christian perhaps, inscription, called by the fantastic name of NCE-156. So it's got a proper scholarly record here. That's tagged NCE-156. Inscription in Greek. It's dated to the latter half of the second century. It alludes to various Christian beliefs. I quote, if it is in fact a second century inscription, as I think it probably is, it is about the earliest Christian material object that we possess, says Gregory Snyder, blah, blah, blah. Details the finding in the most recent issue of the Journal of Early Christian Studies, believes it to be a funereal epigram incorporating both Christian and pagan elements. And it's not the sort of thing that we would inscribe on the urn of dear departed Aunt Matilda, but it's a whole other culture of the past, but this is the funereal sort of poem. It sort of poetic imagery here. To my bath, to the brothers of the bridal chamber, carry the torches here in our halls. They hunger for the true banquets, even while praising the Father and glorifying the Son. There, we think with the Father and the Son, is the only spring and source of truth. So you can see it's saying something about sort of we're carrying you, we've prepared you, we've bathed you, we're carrying you to the banquet beyond, where you meet the real source of truth. Some sort of saying this may have some sort of Gnostic sort of overtones to it. But nevertheless, the line of praising the Father and glorifying the Son is very redolent Christian imagery that seems to speak of the divinity of the Son in the same breath of God the Father. Latter half of the second century, so that would say plump for 175 AD, something like that. Now, John Loftus, atheist, claims that Christians gradually developed a higher, more glorified view of Jesus in a process of deification that he said took at least 70 years. Now, that claim is, at the moment, consistent with the archaeological record. I can't undermine that by pointing at something we've dug up, a stone or an epigram or a picture. But it is clearly not consistent with the textual evidence. We've looked at some of that already when we looked at the miracles claims in the four Gospels. But even if you don't go to the Gospels, go to the letters. I've been thinking more recently about the sort of apologetic use of the New Testament letters. And here's a graph showing the approximate dates of publications of the rest of the New Testament apart from the Gospels. So if we have here the crucifixion in say, 33 AD, then probably the last book of the New Testament to be written and published was Revelation. It's all in the first century. We go back to the letters, John, Jude, so on, tracing back. It seems to be generally agreed, and I've read a fair number of the commentaries and so on thus far. It seems to be generally agreed that probably the letter of James might be the earliest New Testament document published, say, about 48, 50 AD. Gradually having a more and more glorified view of Jesus, a sort of evolutionary of Christology, as it's called, towards a high Christology, thinking of Jesus as divine. Well, that would put people thinking about Jesus as divine for the first time round about the end of the first century. But then what do you do with in the Titus, letter to Titus, when Jesus is called our great God and Saviour in the book of Titus? Or in Colossians, about 60-something AD, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, says in Christ. Or James. Let's look at James, the earliest letter. I think this is fascinating. I was talking earlier today with Dirk Jonkheim from Tyndale House in Cambridge, because I wanted to run this past him, because I haven't seen anyone make this point before, and I wanted to just check whether or not I was being kooky. You know? So I had a chat with Dirk, and he thought it was interesting. And there's in James 2:7, you find this. James talking about the ones who are blaspheming the noble name of him to whom you belong. Now, I've said before, Christians were not first called Christians by themselves, but by non-Christians, who gave them the name Christian. And the name Christian literally means slave of Christ, or follower of Christ, where the word's literally slave. So you could see it could be a sort of derogatory term, or you're slaves of Christ. But then, of course, Christians might be thinking, oh yeah, well, Jesus did talk about, you know, either being slaves to sin, or we have this kind of, you know, imagery adopting that kind of thing. And who is the name to whom, the noble name to whom a Christian belongs, other than Jesus Christ? Well, that's the name that they're being called by. I mean, of course they think they belong to God the Father, but they're not being called God the Fatherians or God the Holy Spiritians. They're called Christians. So this is a good book, The Case for the Divinity of Jesus by Dean L. Overman, who's a lawyer by background. Says the earliest literary sources in our possession that we know for certain were written within decades of Jesus' death contain these devotional creeds and hymns and liturgical formulae that pre-existed those literary sources and were then incorporated into them, a bit like the sources behind the Gospels. And they present compelling evidence of a pattern of worship of Jesus as a resurrected divine being, dating from a time almost contemporaneous with the events. And here we can point out about things about Jesus being prayed to and worshipped from the very beginning of early Christianity, in the so-called undisputed letters of Paul, written before the end of the 50s AD. They demonstrate a concept of a divine Jesus was already present 16 to 20 years after the crucifixion. J.P. Moreland, again, talking about Paul's letters containing a number of creeds and hymns. They often translate very easily back into Aramaic, and they show features of Hebrew poetry form and thought forms. And that means they came into existence while the church was heavily Jewish, and thus heavily monotheistic. And that they became standard, recognized creeds and hymns before their incorporation into Paul's letters. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been any point quoting it as a sort of teaching or authority kind of source. And they constantly present a miraculous divine Jesus who rose from the dead. So, you know, the famous so-called trilemma, lunatic, liar, Lord, argument for the divinity of Jesus. And the new atheists do engage with this. This is one thing that they do engage with. having conceded that Jesus was, quote, a real historical person in a 2013 debate with William Lane Craig, having earlier been skeptical, but Craig pointed out to him that he was wrong about this, and he did change his mind, credit to him, about it. In a later debate, Lawrence Krauss said that Jesus was a real historical person. And then he said that he had delusions of being God. Well, okay, he's rejecting the truth of Jesus' claim to divinity, but Krauss is conceding the existence and sincerity of that claim on Jesus' part to be divine. Christopher Hitchens admitted that Jesus, quote, reportedly believed himself, at least some of the time, to be God or the Son of God.
You just hear him using that phrase, at least some of the time.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes. As if that makes any difference to the argument that would follow. So, given that claim, and many people attack Lewis's famous formulation of the argument, although he wasn't really in context doing this as an argument for the divinity, quite as assuming that Jesus made those claims historically. I'll just simply say, yeah, Lewis's argument kind of kicks in once you give that claim, and they've just given it to me, so I'm going to run with it, and I think you can argue for it historically, previous to mounting this argument. A man who was merely a man, said Lewis famously, and said the sort of things Jesus said, would not be a great moral teacher. Remember back to earlier on when we were looking at Colin McGinn saying, I respect the ethical teachings of Jesus. He's a great moral teacher, but I dump all the supernatural baggage. People are still saying the same things today. Would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says, I'm a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell, i.e. a very overblown way of saying he would be a blaspheming, conniving liar. You must take your choice. Either this was and is therefore the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let's not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He's not left that open to us. Put that to McGinn. And of course, Krauss says that he had delusions of being God. So Krauss is prepared to say, yeah, Jesus claimed divinity, and I think he was a mad guy. Okay, so he's prepared to bite the bullet on that one. Journalist Fanny Kiefer asked Richard Dawkins his view on this argument, though. When you read some of C.S. Lewis, why do you think someone who's a scholar is grabbed by faith? Dawkins, well, you could pick a much better target than C.S. Lewis. He was, after all, a professor of English. Just like G.A. Wells is a professor of German. a professor of English. He was trained at Oxford in classical philosophy and taught philosophy at Oxford for a year. and has been influential for a reason. And no doubt a very good one. But when you read some of his arguments, they're just pathetic. Things like, well, Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, so either Jesus was mad or bad, or he really was the Son of God. I mean, it didn't seem to occur to him that Jesus could simply be mistaken. Sincerely and honestly mistaken. I mean, what a pathetic argument. Now, you just had, as an audience, the reaction to what Richard Dawkins said there that every single audience that I've read that quote to has had. You were laughing by the end of that last paragraph because it is so patently absurd. In other words, we've had this, if Jesus claimed divinity, well, that's either true and he's Lord or false. And if it was false, then either he believed it or he didn't. And if he didn't, he's a liar. And if he did, he's a lunatic. And Dawkins says, well, this is far too simplistic. There's another option. This is a false trilemma. Obviously, you've got the option that Jesus was just honestly mistaken. It was false. He believed it, but he was wrong about that. But he wasn't mad. He was just mistaken. A fourth possibility, almost too obvious to need mentioning, is that Jesus was honestly mistaken. Plenty of people are, he says in the God Delusion. You know, sometimes I think I've left my keys in my pocket when actually they're on the mantelpiece. Sometimes I think the butter is in the top shelf of the fridge when actually it's ended up in the bottom shelf. Sometimes first century Palestinian Jews go around claiming to be divine sincerely, but they're not, mad. You know, they're just honestly mistaken. Yeah, pull the other one. Stephen T. Davis points out it is not easy to see how any sane religious first century Jew could sincerely but mistakenly hold the belief I am divine. Okay. Nicky Gumble, I think, he's the guy behind the Alpha course, nails this one with a bit of wit. He says, the irony of the God delusion is that Dawkins says that all Christians are deluded because they believe there is a God. But Jesus was not deluded, even though he thought he was God. I love that wit. So I really think this is practically the least plausible alternative explanation of what's going on here. It would be, I think, more plausible to say with Krauss that Jesus was a lunatic than to say that he was just honestly mistaken. As Mike King says, anyone honestly mistaken in such a way would inevitably be considered insane. But here's the kicker. Why should Dawkins et al. Not be content to simply dismiss Jesus as mad or bad? Why not join Lawrence Krauss, Richard Dawkins? Well, quite clearly, it's because even a rudimentary flick through Jesus' life demonstrates both of those possibilities to be untenable. Why does Dawkins feel the need to create this extra category and not to go for lunatic or liar? What's so difficult about that? I mean, Lawrence Krauss does it, but maybe Dawkins knows a little bit more about the historical record and thinks it doesn't really fit, maybe. Because Dawkins does say there's no evidence Jesus himself was barking mad. So he sees the difficulty with invoking, as Krauss does, the lunatic category for Jesus. And also Dawkins doesn't think Jesus was a deceiving liar. He doesn't think that really fits with the fact that he does think he was a good moral teacher. He says Jesus was a great moral teacher. He acknowledges the moral superiority of Jesus. He talks about his genuinely original and radical ethics. It was not for nothing. I wrote an article called Atheists for Jesus, says Dawkins. So like McGinn, he wants to say Jesus was nothing but a good moral teacher. And as Lewis excellently points out, that just really doesn't square as a hypothesis. So, to the extent that these are unlikely and doesn't fit with the rest of our evidence, so to that extent it pushes us towards the Jesus is Lord theory. Now, I wouldn't myself present this as a knockdown argument for the Christian view of Jesus. I would use this as part of a cumulative case of arguments. It's one of the five arguments I give in my book, Understanding Jesus, Five Ways to Spiritual Enlightenment. So I use it as part of a cumulative case, but I certainly think it's something that should make the skeptic uncomfortable with Jesus and want to dig in more. It should put a stone in their shoe, as Kuchel puts it. Okay, we can expand from a trilemma to a quadrilemma, if you like, but it doesn't seem that makes it any more of a plausible response than the other two pre-existing alternatives to Jesus is Lord. How do the new atheists respond to the evidence for the historical resurrection of Jesus? And the answer is they don't, because they say there isn't any. despite having debated people, some of them, like Bill Craig, who's an expert on the matter, who will give one of his famous five arguments for the existence of God, he gives in practically every debate he does, is explaining the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. So, yeah, Chris, you had a...
Sorry, it's just that E.O. Wilson was the person who described it.
Ah, thank you. It was E.O. Wilson who described Dawkins as not a scientist anymore, but a journalist. Thank you. So they just don't engage with this literature. I mean, I really don't think that the New Atheists kind of read an introductory textbook to New Testament studies between them. Because you find things like Christopher Hitchens misunderstanding basic terminology in the field, like synoptic, which refers to the Matthew, Mark, Luke, rather than John, because there's information shared between them. He doesn't understand about Q. Christopher Hitchens says that scholars think that all of the Gospels in the Bible are based on Q. So he just hasn't cracked open a, you know, New Testament Studies 101 book. It really would, as someone else sort of said, I think it was Terry Eagleton talking about Richard Dawkins criticizing religion, saying, can you imagine yourself in the shoes of a biologist being critiqued by some religious fundamentalist whose only knowledge of biology comes from having read the something like, you know, the Penguin Book of Birds. And if really it is like that. So Dawkins here, he says, the evidence that Jesus rose from the dead is zero. Another quote from Dawkins, account of Jesus' resurrection are about as well documented as Jack and the Beanstalk. Lawrence Krauss, the point about the resurrection is there's no evidence of it. But again, let me take you back to where we started in the conference, saying they make these claims that seem like they're saying, oh, you Christians have got an evidence problem. You just have this blind faith and there is no evidence, and that's silly, isn't it? And if you don't know better, you think, oh, well, I don't want to have blind faith. That's bad, isn't it? That's surely bad. And evidence is good. And Christians don't have any evidence because it's all about blind faith. And I don't want to do that. But if you know, you know, a smidgen about the area, if you know of the existence of people like William Lane Craig debating prominent scholars within the field, like this is his debate with Gerd Ludemann, Jesus' resurrection, a fact or figment, or Gary Habermas debating Anthony G.N. Flew when he was still an atheist, or Richard Swinburne's The Resurrection of God Incarnate, or N.T. Wright's The Resurrection of the Son of God, which is about this thick, by the way, before you decide to buy it. You can use it as a doorstop when you finished it. Or equally usable as a doorstop when you finished it, because it is well worth reading, The Resurrection of Jesus by Michael Lycona, who's who was a younger guy who worked with Gary Habermas on several books before striking out on his own research in the area. And, new atheists behave as if this sort of literature doesn't exist, or as if they didn't, you know, hear what Bill Craig said in his debate with Christopher Hitchens, or, they've never met John Lennox, of course, although Dawkins has debated him twice, and so on.
I think I read that Bart Ehrman, he acknowledges that it's beyond any doubt that the early believers really believed that Jesus was raised from the dead.
Right. Yeah, I think there's been a bit of an evolution in Bart Ehrman's thinking, but certainly Bill Craig used to quote Bart Ehrman as believing all four of the basic facts that he would mount a case from. I think Ehrman may have wobbled on one or more of those more recently. But certainly, I mean, when guys like Craig sort of say these are generally accepted within the Historical Guild, the comeback that you get from guys like Peter Atkins is, oh, well, of course, New Testament scholars would think that because they're all blind faith, Bible-believing Christians who desperately want it to be true. And that's just not, if you know anything about the history of New Testament studies, this is not the case. And you know that guys like Craig and Habermas and so on are referring to very liberal, atheist New Testament scholars like Gerd Ludemann, like the folks in the Jesus Seminar, who are really at that fringe end of New Testament scholarship, who nevertheless, as you say, will accept these basic facts whilst thinking that the New Testament is generally unreliable and that miracles don't happen and that there isn't a God and so on. But yeah, of course Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Of course he was buried. Of course the tomb was found empty, etc. So again, Jewish New Testament scholar Yusuf Hermes, in his book on the resurrection, he says the idea of the resurrection of the dead was a bit of a latecomer in Jewish thought, occupied a small area of the religious canvas of the Judaism of Jesus' day. I mean, the Sadducees, who were in charge of the temple, didn't believe in resurrection. The New Testament completely altered the vista, changed the perspective with the individual resurrection of one Jew, Jesus predominating the view. Set in time and space, integrated into history, the situation is profoundly perplexing, and the historian must come to grips with this puzzle. But the new atheist response is, what puzzle? There isn't a puzzle. So I'm going to skip through some of this. Again, Bart Ehrman, in a debate with Bill Craig, says, well, of course it makes sense to Bill to believe in the resurrection because he believes in God. You know, but I don't, so it doesn't. But, well, again, as I said at the beginning, you don't have to presuppose theism. If you presuppose agnosticism, if you're just open to the possibility of there being a God, since if there were a God, he could do miracles, you have to be at least open to the possibility of miracles. And as John Ehrman says, not Bart Ehrman, but John Ehrman, who did the critique of Hume's philosophy on miracles, said, really a good theory of knowledge needs to be open to being convinced by evidence at some point. Otherwise, you are just being obscurantist, right? You know, the new atheists are obscurantist on the matter. So you can use, again, remember our criteria of authenticity, back to our New Testament letters. You know, Galatians, 16 years post-crucifixion, talking about being crucified with Christ as a Christian. Jesus Christ and God the Father who raised him from the dead. 16 years after. Paul's letter to the Corinthians, 54, but this is one of those areas where, as J.P. Moreland and others pointed out earlier, you get these creedal passages that give us earlier insights. So very famously, of course, 1 Corinthians 15:3-9, Paul quotes to the Corinthian church this creedal material that he'd had handed on to him and that he reminds them he had handed on to them on his previous visit earlier. And we can date this back through other references and so on. And we can get the bits that are Paul in yellow and the creedal material in white here. You get Jesus as he was crucified in 33, although this is 54, he's reiterating teaching he passed on to them in 50, that's 17 years post-crucifixion. And again, the general scholarly guild view is that Paul probably received that creedal material in Jerusalem from Peter and James about AD 37. He might even have received it from the Damascus Christians, of course, right after his conversion. Most would say AD 37, by which time it had already been formulated into a creedal form that they could give him, that he would then pass on to the Corinthians. And here, you know, again, atheist Gerd Ludemann, the elements in the tradition from the Corinthians Creed are to be dated no later than 3 years after the death of Jesus. Atheist Michael Gulder goes back to what Paul was taught when he was converted a couple of years after the crucifixion. Done. He's a Christian, but a famous Christian New Testament scholar, dates it within months of Jesus' death. The oldest phase of all, Albert Wilkins. Pinchas Lapid, who's a Jewish scholar, said that the creed could be considered as a statement of eyewitnesses because it's formulated by the Jewish church within months, years of the events. Anthony Flew, as an atheist, admitted the evidence of Paul is important and strong because he'd been an opponent. I think this has to be accepted as one of the most powerful bits of evidence that there is, which is interesting. So Lawrence Krauss's assertion that the earliest reports of Jesus' resurrection, he says, come from decades or hundreds of years after the fact, says Lawrence Krauss, is just demonstrably wrong. Demonstrably wrong. Even very liberal atheist New Testament scholars know what they're talking about, will say the earliest information we have about Jesus' resurrection come from a couple of years, if not months, after the crucifixion. You can piece together, and in talking about multiple independent sources of information, it's interesting to line up here four sources. So you've got the 1 Corinthians 15 creed, Mark, the earliest gospel, and if you take the pre-Mark and Passion source idea, you've perhaps got a narrative that goes back to about AD 37. And Acts here, I've got Peter's Pentecost sermon from AD 33 and the sermon of Paul in Antioch in about 45. Now, of course, Acts itself wasn't published until later than that. But James D. Dunn comments, Luke has sought out much earlier material as incorporated it into the formalized expressions he attributes to Peter, Stephen, Paul, etc. And Bart Ehrman concurs, the speeches in Acts are particularly notable because they are in many instances based on oral traditions. These speeches incorporate materials from the traditions about Jesus that existed long before Luke put pen to papyrus. So when Luke is quoting Peter's sermon from Acts, and he's told us at the beginning, I did my research and went to the sources, and we know he'd been to Jerusalem and so on, he spent time there, he's had the opportunity, it's probable that he's summarizing what the, you know, those on the ground at the time, within a generation of it happening, are passing on as the oral tradition here. So you've got multiple early independent sources all saying the same general structure about Jesus dying, being buried, being raised, appearing. So you know, Craig pointing out about Paul's personal acquaintance with a lot of the people involved that that you can quote there, guarantees that the appearances occurred. You've got multiple sources for the resurrection appearances. Even bracketing off the added ending of Mark, before the added ending of Mark, you've clearly got an indication that a group appearance is believed to have happened. Because the angel says, you know, go on ahead of him, he will appear to the disciples. It's interesting to see Jesus was reportedly seen on at least 10 different occasions. In 8 of those occasions, it's also reported that people heard and or talked with, had a conversation with Jesus. On at least 2 occasions, people touched Jesus, we're told. At least 7 reports concern appearances to groups of people. And we've got multiple independent sources for at least 2 individual and 3 group appearances of the resurrected Christ. And it's some of that detail that makes the sort of, oh, they were just having a hallucination kind of way of explaining it away. Highly, highly implausible. I think it ends up really being a utterly unique, miraculous kind of hallucination, which really meets David Hume's rule for believing in miracles. So multiple independent attestation, and crucifixion, of course, is embarrassing. Back to our Aleximenos graffiti here. Crucifixion was such a scandalous way to die. It's absurd to suppose that any group would pretend that their leader had been crucified. Bart Ehrman makes the same point. Same for the empty tomb. The fact that you've got evidence from female witnesses, notes Giza V. Mess, who had no standing in male-dominated Jewish society. If the tomb story had simply been manufactured by a primitive church to demonstrate the reality of the resurrection, one would have expected a uniform and foolproof account attributed to patently reliable witnesses, i.e. men in the culture. They would have said men. A note in the 1 Corinthians 15 creed, no women are mentioned. Because they're trying to make it as plausible as possible in this very culturally difficult situation for them. But the gospel writers, who are trying to give a more fulsome account of what happened, have to sort of embarrassingly admit, yeah, it was. And here's a picture from the Dura Europos house church of some women going to discover the empty tomb. That it was women rather than men who were the chief witnesses to the empty tomb. And indeed, the first witnesses to the resurrected Jesus were women. Independently attested by Matthew and John, and embarrassingly admitted. So the kind of 4 basic historical facts that undergird arguments to the resurrection can be established by multiple early independent embarrassing and eyewitness sources. So again, you're pulsing multiple of these historical criteria, And thus those facts are indeed part and parcel of the scholarly consensus, and that's not because the scholarly guild is massively biased towards the Christian viewpoint. And interestingly, today, back in the 19th century, people would advance alternative sort of naturalistic ways of explaining away the miracles. The Jesus inspired the crowd to share their packed lunches, and thus the feeding of the 5,000, and we should all share our food with each other. And that's what you get out of the feeding of the 5,000. But they would put forward, Jesus, he didn't really die on the cross, and he revived in the cool of the tomb. It's always Jesus revived somehow in the cool of the tomb, rather than the freezing cool of the tomb overnight was the last nail in the coffin of the almost dead Jesus. Why do they go that way? And then somehow he managed to get out of the tomb, avoid the guard, and you can establish that, I think, but you don't use it in the minimal facts case, stagger up to the disciples, dripping blood from his still fresh wounds, and say, guys, I've been gloriously resurrected as the Lord of life. Get me to a hospital. It's just... And so one critic would put forward a naturalistic explanation, and the other critics, in order to get their academic publication rate, to keep that up, all about this, would publish a critique of that and say, no, that's patently stupid. Here's my naturalistic thesis, all the way down to more present day things like, Jesus was the result of eating magic mushrooms or whatever from the 1970s views. It's like, nowadays, the guild will generally accept the basic historical facts that I've mentioned and say, we don't know what happened. Because they're back to those criteria of demarcation. They're back to saying, well, because we know there's no God, a miracle can't have happened. I don't know what did happen, but it can't have been a miracle. Or, well, even if miracles are possible, we can't ever know that one's happened. So we just don't know what happened to Jesus. We know that people thought they saw him alive, but that's all we can say. Or that's all we can say because I'm a historian, and when I'm doing history, I'm not allowed to go outside of the naturalistic box. So I'm not saying that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, I'm just saying nothing about it. Because I'm doing history. And that's where they are. So Guise Vermes, in his book on the resurrection, he admits the basic historical facts. He spends a chapter looking at six alternative theories of what happened that are not Jesus rose from the dead. And at the end of that chapter, he says, all in all, none of the six suggested theories stands up to stringent scrutiny. And then the book finishes. So again, it's not about the paucity of evidence, it's about the presuppositions that you bring to your willingness to look at, to engage with, to follow the evidence to certain conclusions. Anthony Flew, I don't think it's possible to offer any satisfactory naturalist account of what happened. That really represents the sort of majority view these days on that matter. But I'll leave you with this thought from Rob Bowman and the Alex Aminos Graffito. He says, it would never have occurred to anyone in the first century to invent a story about a crucified man as the divine savior and king of the world. Something extreme and dramatic must have happened to lead people, especially such people in such a time, to accept such an idea. Something like he's rising from the dead. That would certainly fit the bill. And I would argue that the best explanation of those basic historical facts, in terms of, again, kind of standard criteria of explanation, like scope of explanation, encompassing as much data as possible, simplicity of explanation, power of explanation, ability to make it probable that we would find the evidence we do indeed find, and so on, would lead us, if we follow the evidence, to at least if we're following that in the context of the life of Christ, at least if we're open to miracles happening, if we don't rule off discussion or engagement with it from the table from the get-go, then we are led to the Christian historic view of these matters.